Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for January 2014. Our topics include the risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding with short-term use of serotonin reuptake inhibitors. We'll also look at schizophrenia complicated by hepatitis C and hepatic encephalopathy. Schizophrenia is also the focus of a report from a large longitudinal study in which neuropsychological functioning was tracked from childhood to age 38. We'll also feature a clinical trial that compared psychoanalytic psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy for bulimia nervosa. And two articles relate to anxiety disorders. One reviews the relation of childhood separation anxiety to adult anxiety disorders, and the other one compares approaches to refractory social anxiety disorder. The article on treating social anxiety has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the January highlights with our clinical case conference by Mark Vieron and colleagues. They focus on a patient with schizophrenia complicated by chronic hepatitis C and hepatic encephalopathy. The case also features substance abuse, which is common in schizophrenia and is an important vector in transmitting the hepatitis C virus. Alcohol abuse can hasten the progression of hepatitis C complications and decrease treatment response rates. The current aging cohort of infected people will contribute to an increasing prevalence of cirrhosis and its complications, such as hepatic encephalopathy. Mental health professionals caring for these patients must remain vigilant for hepatic impairment and its complications. Signs and symptoms of hepatic encephalopathy include attentional impairment, confusion, disorientation, slurred speech, mood changes, alteration in sleep patterns, and lethargy or somnolence. It may also present with persecutory delusions, delusional misidentification, and Schneiderian first rank symptoms. Findings on physical examination may include flapping tremor, clonus, nystagmus, and a positive Babinski sign. To diagnose hepatic encephalopathy in a patient with schizophrenia, it must be distinguished from psychosis and other causes of mental status change. General indicators that may suggest delirium or encephalopathy include a sudden change in mental status, an underlying medical illness, visual hallucinations, fluctuating levels of consciousness, and the acute onset of new psychiatric symptoms. Such indicators may overlap with substance intoxication or withdrawal states, so toxicology screening is imperative. If hepatic encephalopathy is suspected, it's necessary to exclude other potential causes of delirium, including infections, metabolic disturbances, intracranial hemorrhage, seizure, and stroke. Serum ammonia levels correlate with the severity of hepatic encephalopathy. In the setting of liver disease and the absence of other sources of delirium, a high ammonia level supports the diagnosis of hepatic encephalopathy. Prompt treatment is usually effective, but symptoms tend to recur. Treatment employs ammonia-reducing interventions and addresses the precipitants. These include dehydration, gastrointestinal bleeding, constipation, infection, dietary protein excess, renal failure, electrolyte disturbances, and metabolic acidosis or alkalosis. Susceptibility to hepatic encephalopathy is increased by substances that contribute to further liver injury, such as alcohol, and by medications that cause CNS depression, such as sedatives, hypnotics, and opioids. Psychiatrists must work to minimize CNS and hepatic insults from psychopharmacology. For hepatically metabolized medications, impaired hepatic functioning leads to delays in reaching steady-state concentrations and prolonged elimination half-lives. So many commonly used psychiatric medications should be titrated more slowly and given at lower doses. In cirrhosis, glucuronidation pathways involved in phase 2 metabolism may be relatively spared, so medications that rely primarily on phase 2 pathways are preferable. These include some benzodiazepines, such as oxazepam, lorazepam, and temazepam. Medications with extensive first-pass hepatic metabolism can produce excessive blood levels and side effects at standard doses in the setting of liver disease, and they should be carefully titrated. Such medications include chlorpromazine, olanzapine, quetiapine, methylphenidate, buspirone, bupropion, fluvoxamine, sertraline, venlafaxine, and most tricyclic antidepressants. Most long-acting injectable antipsychotics should be used with great caution. Antipsychotics with minimal hepatic metabolism, such as paliperidone, may offer the most predictable pharmacokinetics in hepatic impairment. Many medications affect hepatic function, so it helps to consult the package insert or a medication reference book. Many benzodiazepines and other sedatives, including zolpidem as well as medications with anticholinergic properties, can precipitate or exacerbate hepatic encephalopathy. Illicit substances, including cocaine and opiates, may have an exaggerated physiological impact, so patients should be informed of the dangers and abstinence should be a treatment goal. Psychiatrists must also aggressively treat comorbid alcohol use disorders in patients with liver disease, again with abstinence as the goal. Our review article focuses on childhood separation anxiety in relation to the pathogenesis and treatment of adult anxiety. Barbara Milrod and colleagues point out that the fear extinction model of anxiety focuses on biological underpinnings and on plasticity of a critical behavioral response. Separation anxiety and attachment models address complementary aspects. Separation anxiety is often comorbid with mood, personality, and other anxiety disorders. Among patients in anxiety disorder clinics, those with separation anxiety disorder have greater disability, more severe depression and anxiety symptoms, and larger stress responses than other patients. 3/4 of patients seeking treatment at anxiety disorder clinics report having had separation anxiety disorder in childhood. Its developmental role in panic disorder has long been considered formative. From the perspective of neural systems, separation anxiety may indicate excessive activation of fear circuits in response to separation, as well as overactivation of reward circuits with reunion. However, it seems possible that these functional abnormalities do not cause, but rather result from, abnormalities or deficits in systems underlying social representation and cognition. Childhood separation anxiety often arises in the context of anxious parenting. A parental sense of incompetence in facing children's anxiety can aggravate the child's symptoms. And separation anxiety clusters in families, so it may not emerge as a treatment focus in adults. They may normalize living with profound restrictions that are consonant with family worries and accepted frameworks. Parenting style, the level of parental anxiety, especially surrounding separations, and the parent's ability to tolerate their child's distress without intervening all affect the onset of anxiety disorders in childhood. The parents themselves may not have anxiety disorders. There's a complex relationship of genetic predisposition, early experiences, and development of anxiety in later life. Attachment style likely depends on subtle parent-child interactions, responses to children's distress and anxiety, and the available capacity to moderate stimuli. Secure attachment styles and supportive social relationships putatively buffer the negative impacts of acute, overwhelming stress. Anxious attachment style and high separation anxiety likely compromise the ability to modulate stress with social supports for several reasons. People with separation anxiety develop fewer social supports. They approach them more cautiously, and the social supports they have are more emotionally fraught and less supportive. Patients with separation anxiety have profound sensitivity to transitions and losses, including those experienced in therapeutic relationships. Because separation anxiety is often normalized, patients and clinicians may hardly recognize its presence or potency. It fuels chronic anxiety and a global sense of inadequacy and incompetence, and these can undermine psychiatric treatments of any modality. To enable change, the psychotherapist must consistently focus on separation anxiety and the distortions it evokes to facilitate its verbal articulation. The dyadic nature of psychotherapy leads us to predict that attachment styles can affect psychotherapy effectiveness. Conversely, attachment styles can change. Several studies have shown that psychotherapy can render attachment style more secure. Psychodynamic and interpersonal psychotherapies for anxiety actively address improving patients' capacity for reflection and helping them recognize and tolerate emotional responses and perceived dangers surrounding attachment. Next, we'll look at the treatment of social anxiety disorder specifically. Most patients remain symptomatic after initial intervention with approved treatments. And so Mark Pollack and colleagues compared three strategies for treating refractory cases. The participants were 180 patients with social anxiety disorder who had not responded to 10 weeks of initial treatment with sertraline. Non-response was defined as a score above 50 on the Liebowitz Social Anxiety Scale. These patients were randomly assigned to three treatments, sertraline plus clonazepam, a switch to venlafaxine, or sertraline plus placebo. This study phase lasted 12 weeks. The two groups who continued to take sertraline took the same dose they were taking in the initial treatment phase. The mean was about 180 milligrams a day for both groups. The mean clonazepam dose was 2.3 milligrams per day. For patients switched to venlafaxine, treatment began with a double-blind cross-titration. The dose was increased flexibly and ended at a mean of 197 milligrams of venlafaxine a day. Remission was defined as a score on the Liebowitz Social Anxiety Scale of 30 or less at the end of the second treatment. The remission rates were 27% for sertraline plus clonazepam, 17% for sertraline plus placebo, and 19% for venlafaxine, but the differences were not statistically significant. Sertraline plus clonazepam produced greater decreases in symptom severity and in disability than sertraline plus placebo, but didn't differ from venlafaxine on these measures. A secondary analysis examined response. This was defined as a score of 50 or less on the Liebowitz scale. The rates of response were 56% for sertraline plus clonazepam and 36% for sertraline plus placebo. These were statistically different. The rate for venlafaxine was 46%, which didn't differ significantly from either of the sertraline groups. The only significant difference in adverse events was in the rate of somnolence, which was more common in the group taking clonazepam. There were only three serious adverse events. These occurred in the sertraline plus clonazepam group, but only one was felt to be potentially related to the study medication. The patient experienced fatigue and shortness of breath, and these resolved after discontinuation of the study treatment. In an editorial, Peter Roy Byrne notes that this is the first benzodiazepine augmentation study in anxiety disorder patients non-responsive to an initial antidepressant. Despite the lack of published clinical trial data, psychiatrists commonly use combined benzodiazepine and SSRI medication for social anxiety disorder. The advantage of benzodiazepine augmentation over antidepressant switch or continuation is important, as it finally provides an evidence base to support this common practice. At the same time, it both confirms and denies clinical lore about the clinical utility of benzodiazepines for anxiety. While this strategy led to statistically greater symptom improvement, it did not produce a greater rate of remission. Benzodiazepine pharmacotherapy has had a checkered history for over half a century. In the 1980s, studies showed that alprazolam monotherapy was surprisingly effective in patients with disabling panic disorder. By the mid-1990s, benzodiazepines had been replaced by SSRIs as recommended first-line monotherapy for anxiety, but they continued to be the most widely prescribed medication class, most often as adjuncts to SSRIs. Clinicians skeptical of their efficacy often suggest that they merely treat non-specific symptoms of anxiety, such as insomnia and restlessness. The findings from the study by Pollack and colleagues aren't consistent with this idea, since the designation of response required significant change in multiple aspects of the core social anxiety disorder syndrome. There's now general appreciation that with careful clinical evaluation and monitoring, especially in older individuals, benzodiazepines are safe and highly effective. Another noteworthy aspect of the study was the change in response among the patients receiving sertraline plus placebo. Simply continuing sertraline produced an additional 17% of responders. A number of studies in anxiety disorder subjects have shown that longer duration of treatment with SSRIs will yield additional responders. However, this is often overlooked by clinicians who are pressured to provide more or different medications to anxious patients frustrated with their lack of short-term response. The limited difference between sertraline and venlafaxine suggests that switching to a different antidepressant class is less effective than augmenting with a benzodiazepine. While some might argue that higher doses of venlafaxine could have achieved greater effect, this notion is thought to be more relevant for treatment of depression. Many anxiety disorder experts feel that higher doses of serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors are anxiogenic because of greater noradrenergic effects. The clonazepam group, compared with the other two groups, had numerically fewer adverse events in multiple categories except for somnolence. Hence, this strategy was both more effective and probably more tolerable. Of note, the incidence of insomnia was markedly lower in the clonazepam group, 13% versus 42% and 36% in the other groups. The SSRI antidepressants have been found to be associated with upper gastrointestinal bleeding in some studies, but the findings have been inconclusive. Confounding factors, such as lifestyle and comorbid conditions, may have influenced the results. Yen-Po Wang and colleagues avoided these problems by using a case crossover design. With this design, each patient serves as his or her own control. The records of psychiatric inpatients with upper gastrointestinal bleeding were retrieved from a national Taiwan insurance database covering 10 years. Records on more than 5,000 patients were available. The investigation compared two time periods for each patient, The case period was the 14 days before hospitalization. The control period was 14 days before the case period. The odds for the risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding after exposure to a specific drug were estimated by the ratio of patients exposed to the drug during only the case period relative to patients who were exposed only during the control period. SSRIs were the only antidepressants associated with an elevated risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding. The elevated risks for fluoxetine and sertraline were statistically significant, while those for other SSRIs were not as great. Demographic data, comorbid conditions, and healthcare utilization were similar in patients taking drugs in the case period only and those taking them only in the control period. The SSRIs associated with upper gastrointestinal bleeding were those with the high and intermediate affinity for serotonin transporter. Those with low affinity were not. In subgroup analyses, elevated risk after SSRI exposure was seen in male but not female patients. SSRIs, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and aspirin were each independently associated with an elevated risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding. For patients taking SSRIs with aspirin, the risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding increased slightly, and the highest risk was observed with the combination of SSRIs and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, or NSAIDs. The combination of all three drug types, SSRIs, NSAIDs, and aspirin, did not further increase the risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Neither benzodiazepines nor non-benzodiazepine hypnotics were associated with an elevated risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Short-term exposure to tricyclic antidepressants, serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, MAO inhibitors, and other antidepressants was not associated with an elevated risk of upper gastrointestinal bleeding. So these drugs might serve as alternatives to SSRIs in psychiatric patients with a history of gastrointestinal bleeding or peptic ulcer disease. Next, we'll look at longitudinal changes in people who develop schizophrenia. They're reported by Madeline Meyer and colleagues and are based on a representative cohort of 1,000 individuals born in Dunedin, New Zealand. They've been evaluated periodically throughout their lives, most recently at age 38. Meyer and colleagues report on neuropsychological changes over time in the 31 individuals who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia in adulthood. The scores on neuropsychological tests given during childhood were averaged across ages 7 to 13. In both childhood and at age 38, the individuals with schizophrenia had lower IQs than healthy members of the cohort. In addition, the disparity increased over time from a 9-point difference between groups in childhood to a 15-point deficit at the last assessment. The healthy group did not have a decline in IQ over time. Schizophrenia was also associated with decreases in a range of mental functions, especially processing speed, learning, executive function, and motor function. Decline was greatest on the digit symbol coding test. However, there was little evidence of decline in verbal IQ or delayed memory. Impaired verbal IQ and delayed memory among the adults diagnosed with schizophrenia could be traced back to childhood deficits, which remained relatively stable across development. The neuropsychological decline was relatively specific to schizophrenia. There was no evidence of decline among individuals in several comparison groups: children with mild cognitive impairment, at-risk children who did not develop schizophrenia, and individuals diagnosed with persistent depression. The neuropsychological decline in the people with schizophrenia was non-trivial. Decreases of a third to three-quarters of a standard deviation unit, more than average for the healthy group, were observed for processing speed, learning, attention, working memory, and motor function. Moreover, the cognitive impairment was apparent in everyday life. Third-party informants were asked to report on cognitive functioning at age 38, and substantially more attention and memory problems were reported for adults with schizophrenia. We'll conclude with the study of psychotherapy for bulimia nervosa. Stieg Poulsen and colleagues compared two types of treatments, each of which was delivered as it's usually implemented. One of the treatments was psychoanalytic psychotherapy. It's been proposed that a central feature of bulimia nervosa is the inability to tolerate and regulate affective experience, and that the bulimia symptoms serve as an attempt to avoid negative affect. A general aim of psychoanalytic psychotherapy is to increase the capacity to recognize and tolerate affects. The authors hypothesized that it would result in reduction of binging and purging through heightened affect tolerance and insight into the psychological function of the symptoms. Psychoanalytic psychotherapy was compared with cognitive behavioral therapy tailored for bulimia nervosa. 70 patients with a diagnosis of bulimia nervosa were randomly assigned to the two treatments. The psychoanalytic psychotherapy involved weekly sessions over 2 years, and the treatment was adapted to bulimia nervosa. The aims of this focused treatment are to increase the capacity to reflect on and tolerate affective experience and to facilitate insight. It uses a non-directive approach that focuses on the therapeutic relationship and involves the patient in a mutual reflection on the function of symptoms and the circumstances that trigger them. The bulimic symptoms are not necessarily discussed in every session, but the therapist helps the patient understand possible connections between eating behavior and affective state. The form of CBT used in this study concentrates exclusively on modifying eating disorder psychopathology. It's characterized by a focus on engagement, emphasis on modifying concerns about shape and weight, and development of skills to deal with setbacks. The treatment comprises 20 sessions, which are twice weekly for the first month. The number of treatment sessions and the duration of treatment were markedly lower in CBT than in psychoanalytic psychotherapy. However, it was decided to compare two treatments of different lengths in order to conduct each one in accordance with clinical practice. The primary outcome variable was the absence of binge eating and purging over the previous month. The two treatments differed in length, and so the two groups were compared at 5 months, which was the end of CBT, at 24 months, which was the end of psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and at the respective endpoints of the two treatments. The results clearly indicate that CBT was more efficacious than psychoanalytic psychotherapy in the treatment of core bulimic symptoms. The proportion of patients free of binge eating and purging was significantly higher for CBT at all three time points. At the end of treatment, the rate was 42% for CBT, and it held steady throughout the observation period. In contrast, only 15% of the patients in psychoanalytic psychotherapy had ceased to binge and purge after 24 months of therapy. Both treatments had substantial effects on global eating disorder psychopathology and on overall psychopathology. However, these improvements generally took place more rapidly in the patients who got CBT. Although CBT showed a clear advantage, the authors point out that more than half of the patients receiving this treatment still had episodes of binge eating and purging, and about a third still met criteria for bulimia nervosa. This concludes our audio highlights of the January issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. psych.org. Next month, our topics will be lurasidone for treatment of bipolar disorder, the role of comorbid anxiety disorders in the outcome of psychotherapy for bipolar disorder, whether knowing one's APOE genotype affects memory performance in older adults, genetic and environmental effects on drug abuse in adolescents, and the risk of autoimmune diseases in people with schizophrenia. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.